This is Kit Trioner, the voice of the Green Arrow.
This is George Newbern, the voice of Superman.
You are listening to the DCAU Review, hosted by Cal and Liam.
Streaming at DCAUReview.com and on your favorite podcast app.
The original Justice League has become a memory.
I am resigning from the Justice League.
What's going to happen to the League now?
We rebuild. From the ashes of that great conflict, a new team has arisen. A much, much bigger team.
Each of you brings something different to the table.
Old friends, new heroes. And as usual, plenty of bad guys jumping up to get beat down.
Calm down, and I'll let you go.
How about you kiss my ass?
Watch out, evildoers. There's nowhere to run. Because this year, they're all around you. The League is unlimited. Original series starring every superhero worth cheering for and then some. Justice League Unlimited.
Where am I exactly?
Among friends.
There's strength in numbers.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 304 of the DCAU Review. I'm Cal, and with me, my good brother, Liam. Liam, we are back home, safe and sound, in the correct universe, the proper universe, as it were, as we return back from our third annual trip outside of our comfort zones and outside of the comfy, cozy world of Detective Comics comics, coming off our third annual April Fool's Day special. Perhaps some new listeners have joined us because we saw a lot of new listens on that on last week's episode. So welcome, true believers, if you've joined us for the week after. We're back here at home, and we are starting a new month of reviews, Liam. We are cracking into season 3 of Justice League Unlimited, and we've got an interesting one to kick things off today.
Absolutely. So to kick things off today, we have the episode I Am Legion. Just going to kick off this whole final season arc of a new supervillain team, a network of supervillains that will rise to rival the now massive JLU Justice League, which includes 50 some superheroes and countless other associates. So it's a big opening episode of this final season, and it's we learn quite a bit about who the players are. So it's a bombastic season premiere, to say the least.
Absolutely, lots of homages to other classic, I guess you could say it's classic DC animation, have come up in this episode. The title is itself sort of a double play on words and homages in and of itself. So excited to talk about everything, of course, as we break everything down with our four categories of plot, visual and animation, music and voice acting with you today. But of course, before we do, we will get the official Internet Movie Database synopsis for this week's episode, which originally aired here in the United States on September the 17th, 2005, meaning I think this is one of the younger episodes of the DCAU that we're going to cover this whole season. I mean, this is the last bits of the DCAU television run here. So this episode, not quite 19 years old as of yet, but we are certainly coming up on that here. So the last bit of DCAU animation outside of the tie-in movies that is not quite 2 decades old yet. So we'll feel like young kids again reviewing JLU once again this month. But Liam, of course, the official Internet Movie Database synopsis is brought to you by, as it always is, by The Pod Tower. Head over to youtube.com/ThePodTower. Or if you're on YouTube, I'm pretty sure you can just go to @ThePodTower now and check out the Pod Tower YouTube channel. The Pod Tower YouTube channel is great because not only does it contain our entire podcast library. Every single episode that we've done to date, including all of our bonus episodes and the spinoff projects that we've worked on, all available in one convenient place for your streaming. But if you subscribe to that channel, you also get the entire Tim Talk library, as well as the ongoing podcast from our friends at Watchtower Database, Jump on the Batwagon, as they too are traversing through the DC animated universe episode by episode. So lots of fun. Head over today and subscribe. And let me just say, you will not regret it. That's youtube.com/thePodTower.
That's right. So this is the synopsis for I Am Legion, which is written by Dwayne McDuffie, directed by Joaquin DeSantos, with music by the Dynamic Music Partners and animation by DR Movie Co. And that synopsis reads as such. The newly escaped Lex Luthor is given a membership test for Gorilla Grodd's expanded secret society.
I mean, you're burying a lot of... You could have included a couple of other details there, but that sure. is, I suppose, is the basic plot of the episode.
Yeah, no, we can fill in the blanks. I think it's a servable. It's a C minus, but it's a passing grade.
Sure.
But yeah, as we open it up, it's already the Nuns and Dynamite is already in process in progress as we open the episode, as we see a police cruiser driving very rapidly down the road in Metropolis. And we see that the man behind the wheel is none other than Lex Luthor, still in his prison oranges, having just escaped custody. He still has the clasps from the handcuffs around his wrists, and he's driving quite erratically, trying to get out of the way of various pursuing officers. And seemingly gets rid of his pursuers, but then goes down a closed road and ends up with a pretty wild crash. He should be dead. He wasn't wearing a seatbelt, but he's not. He's just a little banged up, and he tries to escape on foot, ends up heading down an alley where he is cornered by several agents and officers. And looks like Lex is going to have to give himself up and live to fight another day, when we see a mysterious hand reach right out of the wall, phase right through the wall, and grab him. And we see it's the key, which you would only really know if you're a DC Comics fan, because they haven't been identified him yet. But he grabs hold of Luthor and pulls him through some sort of a portal. And as soon as they're through, the wall is once again solid, and the agents are left there sort of scratching their heads. And they decide it's time to call in some backup after our theme song. We see Superman, Hawkgirl, and Aztec. Man, Aztec making it into the show. He was actually a fun, like, you talk about a guy of a specific era. There's like mm-hmm. I think there's a Grant Morrison JLA run that uses him.
Okay.
And nobody's really ever touched him since. Like,
was he not involved? He wasn't the one in Zero Hour. That's Wave Rider. I'm thinking for correct. Some reason, I always get the
also pops up in the background from time to time.
Correct. Yes. But for some reason, I associate Aztec always with Wave Rider for some reason, but that's not accurate. So even less recognizable or able to pinpoint a particular era.
Okay, Shiera. What's done is done. Let's see if we can pick up his trail. Aztec?
The wall's submolecular integrity has been compromised.
Leptons showing residual weak force interactions?
Yeah. How did you know?
It's a common energy signature of matter phasing technology. I assume it doesn't leave a trail.
No such luck. Maybe Aztec could...
You guys want some coffee? Apparently I got nothing better to do here.
Sorry, we got caught up in the work.
Special Agent King Faraday. I'm the new liaison between the Attorney General's office and the Justice League.
Good to meet you. I'm...
Aztec. I've been well briefed on all of you. Security on Luthor's transfer was lax because it didn't seem necessary. We haven't had a peep out of him since he was arrested for that Brainiac business last summer.
He's a broken man. Just sits in his cell talking to himself.
When he's not stealing police vans, you mean?
That came out of nowhere. We had no reason to think he was an active threat.
Do what you can. Put out an APB, stake out airports, train, and bus stations.
Already done, for what it's worth.
He is, whatever his weird gold helmet does, apparently he can... read energy signatures and Hawkgirl and Superman, and he discussed the phasing technology that must have been utilized, though they begin to puzzle exactly how Luthor had someone in his back pocket that could help him with this. And that here enters Special Agent King Faraday, returning from the episode Double Date, where we previously saw him. And we find out that he is now the official government liaison to the Justice League. So we've learned a few lessons since since we last saw the Justice League. They've made some amends with the U.S. government after nearly coming to blows, and literally coming to blows, I guess, if you count Amanda Waller sending the Ultimate to the Watchtower. Mm-hmm. So they decide they're going to keep each other in the loop, and that. There's some back and forth between Hawkgirl and some of the agents who are very standoffish and don't feel like they should have to call in the Justice League to do their jobs, though everyone, including Faraday, is quick to point out that by not calling in the League when transporting Luthor, that's how they end up in this situation in the first place. So it's a little bit tense, but this Faraday fella seems like he's on the up and up, and that's when we cut back to the Justice League's new digs. They got a new clubhouse.
That's right. The Metro Tower, which is, our new holding place for the Justice League. If you recall, when we last left the Justice League at the end of season two, not including Epilogue. By the way, if you're going back and looking for our review of Epilogue, as we've mentioned countless times, we intentionally skipped over Epilogue. That'll be the last episode that we ever cover of the DCAU, probably the final episode of the podcast, if we can ever come to grips with that. So whenever that will be, 50 years from now, whenever now is, that will be the episode that we review. So the last linear episode, I suppose, that as far as the timeline is concerned, we saw that the Justice League had decided to make some changes, which included having a base on Earth rather than be overlords over them. They wanted to be down with the common folk and be more accessible for both humans and, of course, the U.S. government to work hand in hand with the government. So this is part of their plan to do so. And in there, of course, we happen to see Shayera and the Flash. The Flash is looking wistfully, staring quite creepily. He's being a bit of a creep, hanging out, just staring at fire and ice. Also, two very 90s DC heroes. I don't know how much use or popularity they've gained in the last two decades that have happened after that, but it seems like that to me they are products of the 90s if I there ever was one.
Yeah, they get trotted out usually in some sort of reunion book. Usually also features the Ted Kord, Blue Beetle, Booster Gold, Guy Gardner, those Justice League International characters. Although I think they just had a recent mini series where they moved to Smallville. That was pretty fun. You could perhaps catch up on that on the wonderful DC Universe app.
It's a wonderful app.
It sure is.
Aztec didn't find anything else?
Sorry, Superman. It was a bad lead.
Nobody's fault. When you guys do pick up Luthor's trail, call me. I want in.
You know what? This new monitor duty rotation isn't so bad. No more overnights unless you want them. Only one shift a week and you're done. Wally? I'm telling you, you should let it go out. Why don't you just go talk to her?
Who, me? Talk to her? No way.
Yeah, you'd probably be wasting your time anyway. I hear she's, you know, Brazilian.
Ha ha.
If you're afraid to talk to her, I'll tell her for you.
Don't!
You are so very sad.
We, as we see the Flash sort of wistfully looking off at fire and ice, and it's very clearly that he's interested in fire, but seems to have lost his mojo, so to speak, and it doesn't have the gumption to go up and speak to fire. Shayera, of course, notices it from a mile away and begins sort of chiding him, asking him why he doesn't go over and talk to her. There's some witty repartee via dialogue that occurs, and that's when we get some insight back with Luthor as to where he's disappeared off to, as we get the introduction to Grodd, who, you know, we previously had seen was in the swamp, introducing himself to Luthor and inviting him into a new sort of crew that he's starting, a league of his own, so to speak, if you will, to borrow a colloquialism. So he's introducing and showing Luthor around the fortress that is located in a ghastly swamp. And we'll talk more about sort of the homages to the previous incarnations of this sort of legion as we get into visuals, probably. But Grodd gives him a tour. We see a bunch of different villains hanging about in the fortress here. We spot Metallo and KG Beast, just to name a few. Amongst others, we see Dr. Polaris.
Can I just interject here?
Yeah.
One thing we know about Metallo is that he really hates Lex Luthor.
Yep.
And he's just walking by him, not even blinking. He's too enamored by KG Beast arm gun.
Yes. Okay. I was a bit confused by that as well, because correct me if I'm wrong, do we get more of Metallo on an episode?
He does in a future episode. I believe it's called Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Oh, that's right. That's right. He does show up there on that one. But to be working on a team with Luthor is certainly very odd.
Or at least, yeah. I mean, I get why he's... I mean, we'll talk about it visuals. It's a sight gag because, like, him and KG Beast are, like, comparing hardware. Like, sure. it's a fun little bit, but just that Lex is sauntering on by and Metallo doesn't even react at all. A bit strange.
What is this? A home away from home for members of my organization. I'll admit we're putting on something of a show for your benefit. We rarely have so many members here at once.
Yes, it would take a huge scam to pay for all these people.
Actually, it's the other way around. They pay me. The world's most powerful supervillains banded together with one common goal.
They protect each other from the Justice League.
It's the only way to survive in the modern world. There are so many heroes now, and under the Martian, they're too organized for freethinkers like ourselves to make a dishonest buck.
You're running a protection racket.
A co-op. Everyone's free to go about their own business, but if, say, Batman, Wonder Woman, and The Flash show up to foil your bank robbery, you no longer have to face them alone.
Right. He does it out of the goodness of his heart.
Plus 25% of the gross.
Luthor starts to put the pieces together and starts to assume at this point that Grodd is some sort of justice society, that they're all working together and pulling resources, and that he's paying all of them. Very similar to what we saw in the Injustice Gang from the first season that Luthor sort of put together. And Grodd corrects him immediately and says it's quite the opposite. He's not paying them. They actually pay 25% of their spoils to him as part of sort of a protection racket. Luthor is immediately impressed as he realizes that, as Grodd lays out his plan, that it's more about recognizing that they can't just play as single villains anymore, based on the fact that the heroes are very well organized, all under the watchful eye of the Martian Manhunter, who is who he refers to as the Martian, who has coordinated quite a tactful response to most villainous attempts to succeed. So said, why not? If you're going to show up and say Batman and Wonder Woman fly in and show up at the same time, we'll send some backup to help you out. So it's a very interesting decision, and Luthor is actually fond of the idea, but is not really interested in joining.
I'm just upset because first Grodd steals Mr. Wing's getting kicked out of Bird City for being too radical origin story. Now he's stealing his socialist principles,
sharing
by resources. Offering this shared resource and co-op system.
You know what? They're more similar than we like to admit it sometimes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Imagine
real
if
the original Grodd.
Imagine if these two showed up on the same page in the same comic book at some point. Man, I think my brain. You just have huge galaxy brain at that point. One can only wish. But yes, as the plan continues to be laid out, Grodd tries to get Luthor to commit, but he is not interested. And that is until he reveals that he has a piece of Brainiac. And this entire time, by the way, we've had several points where Luthor has looked over to nothing and began talking to it, and seems to be speaking in the second person? We?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, speaking in the second person a lot of the time. And so it's at this point that we kind of get the visual reveal that Luthor is actually seeing visions of Brainiac and is desiring to be once again reunited with his long-lost love, question mark?
Besides, nobody who plays the game at our level ever quits.
Oh, you got that right. Completely missing the point.
Luthor?
You think you understand me? That you actually have anything to offer? For a brief moment, I attained absolute knowledge. Godhood. Now it's all gone.
You melded with the computer being Brainiac. And at your moment of triumph, the Justice League destroyed him. Tragic. Now there isn't a single piece of him left anywhere on Earth. Except, of course, for this one.
Give it to me.
Salvation comes at a price, Lex. First you do something for me, then you get your precious rock.
Do whatever he asks. My entire program resides in even the smallest part of me.
I could reconstitute you, bring you back to life.
Yes, we could be together again.
All right, Grodd. I'm in.
The reveal of this piece of Brainiac is the only surviving piece of Brainiac, and the only hope that Brainiac or that Luthor has with reuniting with Brainiac is enough of a motivation at that point for the mirage of Brainiac to encourage Luthor to join in the fun. So it's where we set off on our mission, and it's not too long after that where as back at the Watchtowers we talked about, Superman is speaking to Shayera, letting her know if they see anything or hear anything about Luthor to make sure they let him know that he wants in. And that's where we cut off to a mysterious man who's chopping wood on a farm. And I gotta be honest, I had completely forgotten about this portion of this episode. I don't think I watched it. I don't remember us having these on videotape. This was towards the tail end of us getting new episodes on videotape. So I don't know that I saw any of these or many of these prior to ending getting these on DVD. So mm-hmm. When we got these on DVD, I don't know how many times I watched the whole thing from start to finish. I probably picked out my favorite episodes and watched those and on repeat. So this probably wasn't one of those. But yeah, we get the return of Chuck Sirianni, the last surviving Blackhawk from mm-hmm. the Warworld episode, which is incredible. Like, yes. I did not remember this, did not see this coming, and it's a really neat little inclusion as we see this older gentleman chopping wood. He's called out from his farm by his wife back into the house saying there's a mysterious sound coming from the attic. He goes up there and he mentions that it's a sound that he never expected to hear ever again. He opens up this little chest and in it is his Blackhawk uniform as well as a radio. And it's at this point that he calls and phones into the Justice League to let them know that Blackhawk Island has a alert that's going off on it, and they're likely to need some assistance. And this is sort of gives us the heads up that Luthor's mission may in fact be something to do with whatever is happening on Blackhawk Island.
Got something for you. Tell Hawk Girl your story, Mr. Sirianni.
We met a while back, ma'am. Longer for me than for you. When you traveled in time to World War II, you fought alongside my squadron.
You're one of the Blackhawks.
Only one still kicking, I'm sorry to say.
What's the problem?
During the war and for decades after, we captured a lot of weapons. Real sci-fi stuff. We hid the worst of it on Blackhawk Island. We decommissioned the place over 30 years ago, but this morning the old security alarm went off. Might be nothing.
Or it might be someone raiding your armory. We'll take a look. Shayera out. Pick a third for the team. Oh, Yapshagurath. Hey, fire!
Yes?
We've got a mission. Let's go.
That's right. So we see back at the Metro Tower. This is, I think, where some of the Flash and Shiera stuff. I think I jumped the gun on talking about the Metro Tower scenes. But yes, as they receive a message from King Faraday, who is patching in this this former Blackhawk Chuck, who informs Hawkgirl and Flash, who are standing there, that there has been an alarm triggered on Blackhawk Island, which is where they kept a bunch of old memorabilia from the war and the few decades afterwards, including war wheels and some of that crazy technology that we saw in the Savage Time three-parter, and that it could be nothing, but he thinks that they should go check it out. So Hawkgirl and the Flash decide they're going to go, and of course Flash somewhat sheepishly asks Hawkgirl to pick Fire to be the third member of their little team going to investigate this. And so they're off, and first Flash is pretty he's still very sheepish. He doesn't really he can't quite find the words to discuss it, and Fire initially takes that as him not being particularly interested in her in any way, so she goes to sit back down. And so Shiera, all but fed up with Wally's ineptitude here, takes matters into her own hands, shifts the javelin a little bit, and sends Fire off balance, allowing Flash to catch her, and them having a little meet cute here. That's not the term, because they've already met, but you know what I mean.
I do.
But we yes, and we also see that Chuck is decided he's going to go to Black Hawk Island with and look for what's going on there as well. And his wife comes out seemingly like she's going to try to talk him out of it, but instead she's just there to present him with his old colors, and he puts on the Black Hawk jacket as he flies off to meet them as well. And as they continue on into the island, they see that there are giant mechanical vultures.
They're not vultures. They're condors.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I think that's important because one of their villains is like Mr. Condor or something. Well, there's a whole bunch of stuff we'll get to from the DCAU wiki. So you're right. I think they are robot condors who begin attacking the javelin. I think there's also a scene somewhere in here of Luthor, Polaris, and the key trying to get inside the island, and we know the key is good at opening locks. He has a magic gun that opens locks, even if it's kind of rusted shut. So
correct.
That's him demonstrating his value. He can phase through walls sometimes, and
phase people through walls. He can phase others.
Yeah, which begs the question: why couldn't you just like go inside? Why couldn't you just like open a portal inside the vault?
He answers that they're not testing him, right? They're testing.
Oh, okay. Testing
right. So he can aid in some cases, but feels like not really willing to help out all that much.
That is true. I rescind that. The show answers the question, but yes, so they're still on the ground there as the Justice League is beginning to deal with the robot condors. Shiera tries to take one on by herself as they sort of shred the javelin. Fire is holding on to the Flash, keeping him in the air, but it becomes pretty apparent pretty quickly that they're a little bit overmatched, at least while Fire is unable to use both of her hands in the battle. So Flash tells her to drop him and he'll figure it out on the way down. And as she lets him go and they continue to fight, this is also where the former Blackhawk flies again and helps out as well. As between the three of them, Fire, Hawkgirl, and Chuck, they're able to take down these robot condors. And we cut to the ground where Hawkgirl is just reading Fire the Riot Act for dropping the Flash without knowing how he was gonna get down.
He told you to drop him? He's a senior member of the team. You know he can't fly, right?
Hey, ladies! Check me out! I'm just like a helicopter!
I'm sort of like a helicopter.
Don't you ever scare me like that again.
She loves me. She's like the big sister I never had. Only, you know, short.
Wait up.
I know everything there is to know about this island. You're going to need my help.
We've got it covered. And no offense, but you're a little old for this kind of work.
Something's activated the island's defense grid. You want to make it out of here alive, I'm coming with you.
So I was going to say this is very Super Friends, but in the Super Friends, he would just suddenly fly sometimes. So there they at least try to make like a physics reason why the Flash can fly here, or cover, I guess, because he moves his arms in a circle at such a speed that he basically creates two mini funnel tornadoes on his shoulders. He's kind of doing the thing like Iron Man does now, where he has like the little rocket thrusters on his hands.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just doing that with wind instead, and that allows him to sort of safely crash back down to Earth, and that allows him and the Black Hawk, as well as Hawkgirl and Fire, to continue investigating. But before they can get to their confrontation with Lex and the Key and Polaris, there's just a whole bunch of crazy death traps awaiting them, including robot hammerhead sharks and the aforementioned war wheels that we saw in the Savage Time. Although this one is like, instead of spikes on the wheel is just on fire.
Crazy. It
looks really neat. We'll talk about that more in visuals, but there's a whole big battle sequence there as they're all there's some really cool stuff, I think, in how they all use their powers in that sequence as well, because there's a little bit of strategy to it and using them in different ways. And as they're fighting out over the water, there's also like a mechanical octopus that grabs hold of Fire and pulls her under, which the Flash makes another tornado, like a water spout to free her. Whole bunch of action here, which we'll talk more about in visuals. And they're finally victorious, and they're following Chuck towards the vault, where in fact they catch up with Lex, the Key, and Polaris. And I think that you're right, this is where Lex asks the question, why can't the Key just get this himself? And the answer is because this is Lex's audition.
That's right. He has no choice but to prove himself at this point. So as it appears that the members of our Justice League are coming to grips and are going to confront our three villains, they break into the part of the museum, I guess it is, where they encounter Luthor, Dr. Polaris, and the Key. And they're basically telling them at this point it's their time to give up. But of course, there's an engagement of fisticuffs that occurs. We get to reveal a little bit about Dr. Polaris, who talks a little bit about his own his own powers, and we laugh about it because he calls himself a ferrokinetic, which I would have been I would not have ever known the difference. But thanks to the DCAU wiki and the production inconsistencies portion, we understand that despite Dr. Polaris calling himself a ferrokinetic, he actually exhibits the power of magnetokinesis. So the difference is a ferrokinetic has the ability to manipulate and control iron-based metals, similar to how Magneto himself does, which ironically in the comics does. Whereas magnetokinesis is the ability to manipulate magnetic fields around metals susceptible to magnetism. And that's all according to the DCAU wiki. Thank you, DCAU wiki.
Whoever you guys are, you got no business being in here.
Sort of goes with the territory. We're thieves.
We going to do this the hard way, Lex? Please say yes.
You're threatening us with a metal weapon? I'm a ferrokinetic, or hadn't you heard? You've got problems of your own.
That's well,
you know, he's Dr. Polaris. You'd think maybe he would know the difference, but maybe he just called himself Dr. Victor Freeze named himself Mr. Freeze. So maybe he was just Fred Polaris, and then he's like, you know what? I'm going to call myself Doctor now. We don't know how smart he's supposed to be.
Was Dr. Doom a real doctor too?
Like,
I don't know that we know that he was a real doctor. I guess yeah, he was.
He's like a king, and he was at school with Reed Richards. I don't know.
I say he was a peer of Reed Richards, right? Did he graduate? Do we know this? We're not Marvel guys. Send us, as exhibited by our lack of Marvel knowledge, send us your tweet. Let us know if Dr. Doom was in fact a real doctor. But back to this. Thank you, DCAU Wiki, for that helpful tidbit. Dr. Polaris showing his magnetokinesis powers is quite formidable against Shayera, who of course has a nth metal mace that she waves around. So he takes control of that and does a lot of damage against her, and it is even threatening to potentially kill Fire with it. Fire is reminded right then and there by Shayera that magnets lose their power when they are when they experience extreme heat. Hey, what didn't you know? What a coincidence. I don't know if that's factually accurate, but I feel like the DCAU Wiki would have told us if that's not factually accurate. So if you're a scientist and you're listening to this and that isn't, please go make an entry on the DCAU Wiki stat under the production inconsistencies tab, preferably. But yes, so she uses her powers to make the room catch fire, which causes Dr. Polaris to lose his concentration, causing him to drop the mace, which allows Shayera to once again regain her composure and begin kicking some serious ass. This causes Luthor and the others to begin to attempt to leave. They do have with them, or as they are attempting to leave, we notice that Chuck, the Blackhawk, has snuck away and has pulled his gun, following Luthor, who's gone off on himself by himself at that point. But unfortunately, Luthor returns to that central room, noting that he has now taken Chuck hostage. He's overpowered him. Chuck apologizes, saying that if he was 20 years younger, and Luthor cuts him off and said, "You would still be old," which is hilarious.
That's a really mean and funny thing to say.
So funny.
Now, why is it you always find the keys in the last place you look?
Let them go. They're pathetic, but they're with me.
I'm sorry, if I were 20 years younger...
You'd still be ancient. Keep quiet.
The whole island is wired to explode, because of course it is. So they set a timer on the computer, noting the countdown, and make their way out with Chuck, noting that if they follow them, they know what's going to happen. So Chuck is escorted out by the three villains as the three heroes are left trying to scramble and stop the island from being blown up. It appears at the very last second, though, that as the seconds tick down, that they're not going to do so. We cut back to Chuck, who's being escorted by the villains. He's led across a bridge, and he just happens to know the island better than everybody else. So he steps on a false portion of the bridge that they're crossing, and Luthor knows immediately that something's afoot, but not quite what. And we see that some robotic piranhas are released and begin attacking our villains as they jump out of the water. And this gives enough distraction for Chuck to be able to escape. Luthor says they have what they came for, and they're ready to escape themselves. So Chuck is able to make it back into the control room just in time. It looks like Shayera is not able to get the countdown to stop. Flash suggests that they run off the island. Shayera insists that they're not going to allow all this history to be destroyed. She pulls out her mace and is about to smash the computer when Chuck interrupts her and wisely says she better let him try it. "This is a job for a man, you silly woman." I was surprised, honestly, that wasn't the line that he said, being a, you know.
He is of that era.
I was going to say, it would not be out of place for the character, it would seem. But he does step in. And he's able to provide whatever code is required to stop the countdown, thus saving the entire island from blowing up and all of the history that goes along with it. So we get a post-mission script there. Well, actually, back in the control room, they realize what it is that Luthor has stolen, and it seems that it's left our heroes quite concerned. We cut back to the swamp where Luthor has returned with his winnings, and it's the spear of Longinus, which we learn was some sort of spear that Hitler
apparently held in high regard and believed that whoever held it would have some sort of power that would be bestowed upon them. And Grodd is happy to have received the spear.
The spear of Longinus. Hitler believed that whoever holds it is invincible.
What are you going to do with it? Sell it to the highest bidder? Keep it yourself and try to conquer the world?
I was thinking it would look good on the wall in my office.
You mean you recruited me? Sent me to an island full of death traps and up against the Justice League? You made me risk my life and all for nothing?
Essentially, yes.
Monkey, I like your style. Give me the piece of Brainiac and we're even.
Not yet, Lex. Today was just a test. Your next mission is for real.
He still has something we need. We have to put up with him for the moment.
I should kill you.
But you won't.
No. Not today.
So Luthor sort of agrees villain to villain at that point, tips his cap to him and says that if he gives him the piece of Brainiac, he'll be on his way and everything will be even. But Grodd says that that was just the test run, that the next mission is still yet to come. But we get a little postscript as we see back on Black Hawk Island, Shiera and Chuck are standing before this statue of several of the lost Black Hawks honoring them. Fire, talking to the Flash, mentions that she thinks it was a little bit silly and thinks that Superman will probably be furious that to know that they let Luthor get away all just to save the island and all of the history from it. But Flash looks out over and sees Shiera and Chuck there paying their respects. Love Chuck's standing there just saluting the statue. Mm-hmm. And Shiera is sort of there solemnly with her head bowed and says, well, I think it was quite worth it. And we fade to black as we get the end of our first episode of season 3 of Justice League Unlimited.
Yeah, that's right. We get a little taste of what's to come this year with the newly established they never call it the Legion of Doom, but it's the Legion of Doom.
Well, I was going to say the title of the episode, I Am Legion, refers to a biblical story where mm-hmm. there's a man that's possessed by demons and Jesus encounters him and he performs an exorcism where he gets the demons out of the guy and he's speaking to the demons that are possessing this man, and he asks him to identify. Jesus asks the demon to identify itself and it says, "I am Legion, for I am many." But then of course Legion of Doom, I am Legion. So we have Luthor being sort of pseudo possessed by Brainiac as our nod to that story. And then we have, of course, the Legion of Doom. So we do get the nod to the Super Friends there. So I love it. It's kind of a dual faceted homage there.
Yeah, it's a good little bit of foreshadowing there. But yes, we talked about, I think that's in some of the special features on the third season DVD where they talk about when they finally realized they were getting picked up for this final season and they were throwing around ideas. It was Dwayne McDuffie who first brought up the idea of doing a Legion of Doom, and Bruce Timm and I think the rest of the crew weren't so sure right off the bat just because they had already done the supervillain groups a couple of times. But they thought, I think eventually they kind of thought, well, if we do like the full Legion of Doom with the big floating fortress in the swamp and all of the all of these characters in one place and all of that, that could be a fun idea and a little bit of a change of pace and a way to have maybe some more straight up old school superhero adventures as opposed to all of the government intrigue and backbiting that we saw last season. So this is the building blocks for all of that. I like the bit every time they cut where they show Lex talking to Brainiac and we don't see Brainiac because mm-hmm. there's almost always somebody around that's just still like, there's a couple of great shots of Grodd just being terribly confused by what's going on while Lex is carrying on these conversations with someone you can't see. I like that, but I like, yeah, bringing back, some of the stuff from Savage Time, the Blackhawks And you're delving into, I think we'll see a fair amount this final season. It was like, what fun little locales in the DC universe have never been touched in the DCAU. And this is certainly one. And there's certainly a few others that qualify for that as well. So it really feels like this is almost like the start of like the bucket list JLU seasons. This is the final. This is the final season of the final television show set in this universe. So it feels like we're checking some things off along the way as we begin to build out this overarching plot of Lex trying to get back with Brainiac and Grodd sort of manipulating him and forcing him to be part of this this secret society as they go.
Yeah, it is a nice change of pace. Obviously, we spent several different months on discussing that whole Cadmus story arc, and it is, as we discussed during every one of those reviews, it is highly regarded as one of the best, if not the best, story arc throughout the entire DCAU for very good reason. But it makes sense why, when you end on that sort of we talked about it during those reviews, like there are some episodes that are so dialogue heavy and like espionage and government overreach and all of the deep real world stuff that was included, which was fantastic and important. But sometimes you just want to play in the superhero sandbox with your action figures and just bash them together. Like you may want to take a veer to the right as opposed to the left this time, and or left instead of the right, whichever one you want to go to, instead of staying on that same path of, you know, heavy, deep, depressing real world stuff. So the fact that Dwayne McDuffie pitched the Legion of Doom, they loved it. They decided to go with basically a DCAU version of what you and I grew up watching a lot of those Super Friends cartoons.
Oh, yeah.
So, and as did a lot of people, I'm sure, that were watching the DCAU at that time. So you recognize the homages, you recognize the things that they're going for, they're kind of winking at, but it's all done with the DCAU seriousness. It's all done with the, you know, the fun that we're used to having. But the episode itself, I think, like I said, I did not remember the Black Hawk inclusion for this episode, so that was a nice little surprise. I think looking at it, sort of what we talked about last week, where if you were coming into this season and you were trying to say, all right, this is my quote unquote pilot episode, this is my series premiere for this episode, in this case, it's the season premiere for this episode. It's like, what am I going to do to draw people in to have them come back? Is there enough here in this episode that makes me interested or excited as to what's going to happen? And I think there are enough little stories that you started here for this episode, and whether or not they're paid off or not is another story, but you at least have the intrigue of like, oh, you know, are Flash and Fire going to be a couple this year or something like that? Like, is that going to get paid off? Are Brainiac and Luthor going to be a couple this year? Is that going to get paid off? Like, you know, and some of that we know does not ultimately get paid off in maybe the original intended way. We know that the Brainiac thing, I think through some of the accompanying tracks from the original DVD, they talked about how it was going to be eventually revealed that the key was Brainiac, and instead of ultimately what spoiler alert ends up happening at the end, Brainiac doesn't come back. You know, so they don't really kind of pay that off to that point. But I think what we end up with is fine anyway. So it's it's kind of wacky and goofy. And I think, as you pointed out before we went on the air, having them just do a redux of what we just saw with Luthor and Brainiac combining again and having the Justice League have to fight them again would have felt pretty redundant.
Yeah, like I feel like it reduces... Like you could make it like, okay, he's the big threat, he's in the background, and it's about the human drama between the superheroes. That's okay. You can do that with your recurring villain. It's just not that interesting. Like, it's just, yeah, it's not interesting as you compare it to Lex having this overarching multi-season, multi-show arc setting up to this big ultimate moment where he thinks he's getting put into the Amazo body and then transforms into Brainiac instead. And what a kind of a, as we talked about, what a kind of a wild out of left field twist that is, to just come back and be like, yep, he's doing it again, is not that interesting if we're going to be spending, you know, more than a cursory amount of time with our villains, which we always tend to do. So yeah, I think for the interest in making the villain season and putting Grodd and Lex as kind of your two like alpha bad guys of the Justice League run to this point, maybe you could argue, with the exception of maybe a Dark Side, who is, as far as we know, he's dead. So there's not really anybody else that's been portrayed on their level as far as their ability to be one step ahead of these heroes at every turn. So and the idea that it's somehow very old school, like they're basically just running a supervillain mafia, but now you have Lex in a position where he has to be subservient to someone else, even if it's just, you know, him waiting for the opportune time to stab him in the back. It's you're building up interesting sort of interpersonal drama between the bad guys as much as you are the good guys this year, I think, and that starts right in this episode. So yeah, overall, as a standalone episode, I think it's a lot of fun, like you said, with all the coming back to some of those Savage Time moments and Black Hawk Island and all these sort of deep cut DC stuff, and also setting up this new Legion of Doom secret society system that's going to counteract the Justice League. So I ended up settling on a 7 out of 10. I think it's a really fun episode, and it does a lot. It has to do a lot. You got to break Lex out of jail. You got to meet Grodd as the leader of the new group. You got to explain what the new group does. You got to send them on a little adventure. You got to spend some time with your Justice League. You got to have some action, and then ultimately get to the end of the episode to find out kind of where Lex stands in the pecking order of this new group. So they had to juggle a lot. So I think it's a good first step.
Yeah, I went with the same exact score, 7 out of 10 for mine as well, for that very good reason, or for that very same reason. I think that, you know, the action in this episode, as we'll talk about in our next category, it's a very action heavy episode. We get that firefight in the air. We get, you know, the condors fighting the heroes, both in the plane and out of the plane and out in the javelin and out of the javelin. And we get all these weird contraptions, as you already mentioned, on the island. And so lots of interesting and high, like it's action heavy for the most part. Even the opening sequence that we get is a police car chase. Like, it's really wacky and wild and very Fast and the Furious. Like, so you kick things off with an action heavy episode that does have enough of those threads to kind of pull you in and say, okay, where is this going? What's this next mission that Grodd's sending Luthor out on? When is Luthor going to turn his back on him? Because we know that Luthor ultimately has his own, you know, game that he's playing here, and is ultimately by no means a follower. Can all of these villains continue to coexist in one space and work together? Or is it going to implode much like Luthor's group did? You know, all of that is kind of intriguing enough where you look at it, the plot lays a good foundation. You have some great callbacks to previous Justice League episodes, one of the most legendary Justice League episodes with the callback to the Blackhawks. So yeah, it's all good stuff. I think it probably could have been a little bit, I think there could have been some more, I don't know. I think we'll talk about it maybe when we get to voice acting, but it was a little bit distracting with some of the character choices that they made. and it's a little bit hard to really kind of withdraw from that and hear the same person doing the same two of the lead characters in the same scene. But again, we'll talk about that when we get to voice acting. But overall, still pretty strong scores from us, both 7 out of 10. All right, Liam, let's move on to our next category, which is going to be
animation and visuals, which were done this week by the DR Movie Co. And we have direction by Joaquim Dos Santos. So you always know there's going to be, when Mr. Dos Santos is responsible, you always know there's going to be some wild, off-the-wall, wacky action. And like I just mentioned, kicking things off right off the bat, we have just an absolutely insane car chase with cars flipping over and explosions, and you know, the cars are banging into each other and Luthor crashes. And like you said, I think we probably should have had multiple deaths. The guy flying out of the back of the police van, smashing into the windshield of the other cars, like just absolutely an insane way to kick off this third season of JLU. And it did not stop there as we continue. I think that the quietest points that we get are the, you know, the little bit of investigation that we get with Aztec and Superman and Shayera at the beginning, and then the downbeat sort of at the watchtower. But as far as everything else, it just feels like almost nonstop action that middle point on. Once Grodd gives Luthor his marching orders, we get a pretty nonstop action at that point with everything that happens on the Black Hawk Island.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that whole sequence, as you mentioned, and I think it's funny because I often think of like Joaquim Dos Santos' best stuff being like really good hand-to-hand fights. Like I think like some of like the Black Canary stuff that he did in Cat and the Canary and Double Date and things like that, like some real visceral hand-to-hand stuff. And this one, I feel like he along with our animation company really kind of showed off really put the super in the superheroic. Some of the stuff with Fire when she's in her Human Torch form, the Green Human Torch with her fire bikini. I mean, that's always been a very, like, you know, striking and interesting visual look. And there's a shot of her when she first kind of turns into that form and she's flying through the sky where she like flies through a cloud and you see the little, like the cloud particles parting as the heat from the flames is coming off of her. Like there's some really incredible detailing in that. That I think in that first that whole aerial battle at the start with the condors is really, really striking, and the way that everyone kind of struggles and fights against these things, like it's not just, you know, you hit it once and it blows up. Like you'll see Hawkgirl, she's grasped in the talon and she's wailing on it with the mace, and you see it sort of start to crack, and you see some of the wires being exposed, but she can't quite break it, and then you know, Fire comes in with the big energy blast. I think those, like, fire and most of Polaris's stuff, I think that's CG if I'm not mistaken. But it looks, they've by this point in the series, I feel like they've really mastered mixing in those digital effects with the traditional 2D hand-drawn animations. So I think they did a great job with that. But I love that sequence. And then once they're down on the ground on the island, when they're fighting the war wheel, especially, I think that sequence where Fire gets grabbed by the octopus and pulled under the water, which extinguishes her, and the Flash doing the big runaround. This is like a classic Flash thing. You know, run around in a big circle, create a tornado, but doing it on the water. So it creates this giant water spout, which pulls the water levels down far enough for Fire to reignite and destroy the octopus. And then he keeps the water spout going so he can throw it at the war wheel. And then you see the war wheel and some of the hammerhead sharks and stuff get sucked up into it. Like there's some really clever, like, utilization of the power sets, I think, especially for Flash and Fire in this episode.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the Flash doing the helicopter arm tornado thingy is kind of cool. I like that he's not very successful at it and flops over instead of discovering that he can do that and be immediately good at it. I thought that was pretty spot on. He makes a fool of himself in front of this girl that he's clearly trying to impress. I think I think the whole dogfight that occurs in the sky, there's just so many really neat angles that are shown. You know, we get shot of fire kind of bursting through a cloud of fire, like she kind of ignites and then you see her shoot up through it. That continues on outside of that dogfight, as we mentioned. We then get that transition to this weird fight on the beach with the flying hammerhead sharks with guns for eyes. One of the things that caught my eye immediately as we were, and we talked about it before we went on the air, but one of the traps, the robot that Luthor, the Key, and Dr. Polaris run into first as they after they enter into one of the vaults, you don't quite see it outside of silhouette, but very clearly is a visual homage to the Iron Giant based on how it is designed. One of our favorite movies of all time. I dare say top 2-3 cartoon movies of all time, outside of, like, if you're going outside of superhero movies, straight up superhero movies, such a great movie.
Absolutely.
Maybe one day we'll do a review of that or something, because I would love to talk about that movie for hours if possible. But really, really neat. Obviously some corporate synergy there, Warner Brothers. But wouldn't it be interesting, Liam, if you could prove that the robot from the Iron Giant was actually the Black Hawk Island robot? There's a couple things that it's not from this universe, but as you mentioned, Tom Turbine confirmed that anytime that a comic book occurs in one universe, it's because somebody has a link to another universe and is writing about that hero that truly exists in that universe. So Superman comics exist in the Iron Giant movie. I think that we got some sort of connectivity here. We could probably draw some sort of conclusion that there's some sort of existence here.
And I want to say Green Lantern John Stewart name drops the Iron Giant in an episode too.
Okay.
I think it's Hereafter. I think it's when he's fighting the big toy man thing.
Oh, okay.
Like, watch out for Iron Giant. I'm pretty sure.
That does sound pretty familiar. Yeah.
So it exists, whether it's a movie in the DCAU or whether it's a real thing that exists. This one wouldn't be, the DCAU one we see here wouldn't be quite as large as the Iron Giant is in his own movie. Yeah, who knows? Could be there was, maybe the movie is based on a real thing in the DCAU. We don't know. We're just saying there's connectivity here.
There you go. I thought that was interesting. And then of course the actual Black Hawk Island, we get a lot of stuff that's straight up homages, or I guess it's specifically listed amongst the lore of Black Hawk stuff there. And thanks to the DCAU wiki, we didn't have to do much research about this. But of course, tons of references to the Savage Time with the war wheel that we talked about. How about that war wheel that was on fire? That was pretty unique looking.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a cool little, just a little visual update of what we had already seen. But yeah, it's really cool. That whole sequence, as I spoke about, I think is really striking, the way everybody is sort of problem solving with their own unique abilities and figuring things out. So, you know, Flash freeing fire, who roasts the octopus and some of the sharks, and then Flash using the tornado to take out the war wheel that's chasing Shaira and Chuck. That's a really fun little sequence there. And all those designs that we see come back are a lot of fun.
Yeah, agreed. So of course we get some Vandal Savage imagery, a lot of the stuff that saw in that some posters. So this is clearly this is a museum. It's an homage. I think they call it the Museum of Victory, I believe they call it. So we get that. We see some of the other references. Again, this is all according to the DCAU wiki. There is a Killer Shark homage. He was a pirate who piloted a number of sea animal inspired boats and planes. So he's shown there. Piranhas the Kraken and the Hammerhead Sharks were a part of his arsenal of robotic fishes. So there you are. So those were not original ideas from this crew. They are specific homages. We also have a bunch of other things. As you mentioned, King Condor was one of their villains, and that's where the robotic birds came from. We also, the flaming hoops that they have there was related to the Great Hoopla. Man, some really, really interesting stuff here. There's also, of course, the old blue uniforms from Savage Time. A bunch of stuff here. You can check out the DCAU wiki. I'm not going to bore everybody to death with that, but it's really, really good. I love the actual visuals for this episode. Like I said, from that middle portion on, it feels like you just get nonstop action. And then that final scene that we get with the sort of the downbeat where we're come to grips with the idea, like, did the heroes make the right decision in letting the supervillain go in order to protect this history? And I think there's something to be said about sometimes it is important to preserve history as much as possible. You know, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it, right? So this particular choice to save this particular history and the impact that it made, and certainly standing up to the tyrannical leadership of Vandal Savage in that DCAU World War II era, it was certainly important to remember to hopefully avoid that same sort of event from occurring again. So for all those reasons, all the really cool, neat little things, the awful wall action, the really, really neat homages and unique looking items, for all those reasons, I ended up giving Animation Visuals a very strong 9 out of 10. What about you?
Yeah, I went 8 out of 10. I really enjoyed a lot of what we've already talked about. Yeah, the background artists deserve a big shout. Oh, yeah. as we've just discussed, all of the Black Hawk comic book deep cuts and villain suits and all the, there's like different eras of Black Hawk suits from the original comics, similar to what we saw in Savage Time, through some of the revamps that they attempted on the Black Hawk characters in like the 70s and 80s, and even I think you see a Lady Black Hawk who I think she's a character from the past, but she gets brought into present day. She's actually ends up being a big part of Gail Simone's Birds of Prey run. So a lot of fun little like I said, a lot of them are those weird deep cuts like Killer Shark and King Condor, but there's some maybe more familiar things like a Lady Black Hawk and stuff. But yeah, a lot of that stuff is in addition to all the returning props and backgrounds and imagery from the Savage Time episodes. Just a great job all around.
Couldn't agree better. All right, Liam, with our next category will be, of course, our music discussion. And of course, we had our dynamic music partners responsible for music this week. And boy, howdy, we got some really great homages, return of some pretty awesome themes. Luthor's theme from Superman the Animated Series was a surprise, but a welcomed one, to be sure, as we hear that immediately at the beginning of the episode, is after he crashes the police cruiser. As he's running away, you hear that theme sneak in there. And then we also, of course, get the return of the extremely triumphant Black Hawk theme, which got to be a top three JLU era theme, right? Or JLJLU era theme, I feel like.
Yeah, we've talked about this in passing before. It's been a long time since we reviewed Savage Time, but yeah, that's an all-timer piece of music. Blue Lolita Ritmanis, responsible for that original composition back in the Justice League episode. All three of our dynamic music partners credited for this episode, but yeah, just incredible, and bringing it back in a few different ways. Like you hear it when he first opens and you see the plane for the first time. It comes in just for a second, and then it kind of lays out as we have this scene between Chuck and his wife. And again, it seems like maybe she's going to tell him not to go or something, but instead she just hands him the jacket. And, you know, as he holds it up and looks at the Black Hawk symbol, the theme sort of swells back in. And then as you hear it when he makes his entrance into the action beats, with the shout, as we'll talk about shouting the Hawk-a, which is their catchphrase from the comics, which I don't remember them ever actually doing in Savage Time. Maybe I'm wrong there, but another fun little deep cut. But the Black Hawk theme is among, I think, the best pieces of music in any of these shows, and definitely on the short list for the best Justice League Unlimited era compositions by our dynamic music partners. But I think that that use of that theme, and again, it's brought in a little bit at the very end as well, as we see Chuck saluting and Shayera kind of showing tribute as Flash and Fire sort of discussing whether or not it was worth it to let Luthor get away to save the museum. And then they sort of look over at Chuck saluting the statue and Shayera bowing her head, and the theme kind of comes back in there. It's used really well. And it kind of becomes like the theme for this individual episode as well.
Yeah, I agree. You do get some just high action music also. Those two pieces are probably the highlights that I mentioned, mm-hmm. but you do get plenty of action beats which require action music to come in. So the dog fight with the condors, and then the subsequent fight with the hammerhead sharks, all of those include some really intense music. I think also when they reintroduce the Flash as he's doing his little helicopter thingy, there's a cute little theme that plays there. So for all those reasons, mainly though, relying solely on the return of the triumphant Blackhawks theme and the little bitty Easter egg of the Luthor music, I ended up with a very strong 9 out of 10 for music as well.
Absolutely. And I ended up going with a very similar 8 out of 10 for my music score as well. I just think it's, yeah, some really great stuff there. Like I said, bringing back those old themes. I like the little bit of Sting we get when they're in the swamp. Also feels very, very eerie and ominous before the big structure is revealed and we get kind of more of the swelling music there. So yeah, great job by our dynamic music partners.
Absolutely. All right, William, let's wrap things up with our final category of the day, which, of course, is our voice actors and actresses. So very interesting. I feel like it felt like there was only like three voices that were used, and they all just did multiple portions here. We definitely have multiple people playing multiple voices, but it seemed like, I guess because we didn't have as many characters this week, that it just seemed more in our faces this week. But certainly some returning voices, some very important people here, some goats, all to be discussed here on our voice actor and actress list this week.
Yeah, all our regulars are pretty busy in this one, huh? everybody's pulling double, triple, quadruple duty, it feels like. But yes, We'll run down the list here. Some of our guest stars we get Scott Patterson as King Faraday. Folks would probably know him best from his turn on Gilmore Girls. He played Luke on that show. I never watched it, but I know people who watch that show will know who I'm talking about.
Of course.
But yeah, him playing Faraday, it's interesting. I mean, it's just a complete opposite of, he still has a little slickness and like you're not really sure what to think of him to him. But he doesn't have the edge that CCH Pounders Amanda Waller has either. He's a bit more aloof, I guess.
Yeah, I think they want you to sort of second guess as to whether or not he's really on their side. But also, I think the writers, in a way, they almost put that to bed almost immediately because they made it very apparent that this is going to be completely the opposite of what we had in our last season, right? So rather than the Justice League and the government being at each other's throats and there being a lot of distrust, it seems like there's some initial apprehension when he reveals that he knows all about them. But then it's sort of just quelled when we realize that he is truly attempting to partner with them and be a liaison between the government. And he goes to bat for them when he recognizes that, the officers that were responsible for escorting Luthor really didn't do their jobs and were, even though they try and defend themselves and say that, well, we just didn't want to involve the league, we thought we could do our jobs without him. And he goes, yeah, well, here you stand. Isn't that interesting? I feel like you're setting up sort of the counterpart to that person that doesn't trust the league. You have somebody that's going to be more of an ally on their side.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he does a good job of that. And elsewhere we have Seymour Castle as Chuck Sirianni, aka the last Blackhawk. He's pretty fun in this episode. Like he gets a lot to do. He has this very very old time. Like, he feels like a hero from the 1940s. Like, he feels like he's an old fella and he's got some stories to tell. Like, I think he does a nice job, and him playing off of his wife, played by Takeo Fisher, who I think folks would probably recognize if they saw her. She was in Pirates of the Caribbean and a few other things in some minor roles. So I like him as Chuck, being the this one sort of this last tether to the those heroes of World War II is kind of a fun deal. And as mentioned, his highlight might be him playing off of Clancy Brown, who we'll get to in more detail in a little bit. But their brief back and forth is a lot of fun as well. And of course, him playing with Maria Canales as well.
I was going to say his interjection at the very end of, yep, you can't fix everything by hitting it, which is interesting, because I feel like we do see some progression for the Flash character in this, where he realizes he uses a little bit of ingenuity, throws the glass at some of the villains instead of just trying to run really fast and use his fist. It seems like Hawkgirl still hasn't learned her lesson about just using her mace first. but maybe we'll see more progression as we go through the year. But his interactions with her, I thought were great. I even like, you know, the little introduction that we get to him with his elderly wife on their farm chopping wood. I thought that was, you couldn't get more boomer than that, like classically, and I mean that in the most respectful way, like classically boomer. Like, you know, he's on the farm, he's cutting his own wood, he's lived the American dream, and there he is, he's in his retirement, and he's called out for one more mission.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great sequence there of her calling him to find the alarm going off in his old chest in the attic is a great little bit there. But elsewhere, we would one of our most talked about guys, though it feels like maybe it's been a little while since we've mentioned his name, Corey Burton, as boy, he's playing everybody in this episode. he's playing Aztec, he's playing, I think, one of the other agents in that scene, he's playing the key, and of course he's playing what we think is a hallucination of Brainiac, though that's probably I think our friends at Watchtower Database actually have a video about that, so you can look that up for maybe a more definitive evidence on whether or not Brainiac is actually still inside of Lex at this point. But we see him a couple of times talking in the Brainiac voice. But he's got to do everybody in this episode practically. And we talked about, I think this is kind of a known thing, but the key at one point, when I guess the original plan was that that Brainiac was going to return and remerge with Lex at the season finale, the plan was that the key was going to play a big part in that, and that he was going to turn out to be an undercover construct of Brainiac's or something like that. How that would have worked, we'll never know, I suppose. But that is, I guess, why Corey Burton is voicing him, and why he features so heavily in this episode. But of course, you know, Mr. Burton's doing a great job, but yeah, he's even busier than usual, I feel like.
Yeah, I agreed. It's interesting because, I mean, you can tell it's him. And I think, as you mentioned, they were sort of debating whether or not that reveal was ever going to happen. So you kind of had him leaning into it, but yeah, you can tell that it's Corey Burton, but we love any time that guy shows up. We love that guy. He's the GOAT. Like, I would be lying if I hadn't said that I would done research attempting to figure out if we could get him on the show at some point. Like, he's that interesting enough of a person that has done so many things in animation over the years, and anytime he pops up, it's welcomed. But I think he also suffers the same issue that we have coming up in just a moment here, where he plays so many of the same characters that are all in the same, they're like all in the same area, so it does feel like it's difficult to separate. And I think that's okay with the key, because if you were going to reveal him as Brainiac, or even if Luthor sees him as Brainiac, or whatever the whatever you, your headcanon right. wants to be, that you can explain that away. But he's literally the third voice that you hear after Luthor crashes is him as Aztec, and he's not really doing much to disguise that it's Corey Burton. So,
right.
You know, that's not a detriment. We love him, but it is a little bit distracting when you have him playing multiple voices in an episode. Just the fact.
Absolutely. And then some of our other villains here, we do have, of course, Powers Booth returning as Grodd. Awesome. He's such a funny, like, he's got like this real weird wit to him, and he's just really getting off on making Lex do his dirty work. Like, he's just so smug. Grodd in the DCAU is so smug, and obviously a lot of that comes from Mr. Booth's performance.
Yeah, he's pompous, he's arrogant. You gotta love when he reveals at the end that he sent Luthor on this mission to collect this spear, and it really was for nothing. Like, he's so full of himself in that moment, and that he's humbling this guy who, you know, would otherwise think of himself as too important or, you know, above all of this. And he's essentially turned this criminal mastermind into one of his lackeys, and he's just so smug about it. It's so good. You know, unfortunately we lost Mr. Booth not too long ago, and I think on paper, seeing him as the voice of a gigantic gorilla, you're like, I don't know that I would put that together, but I can't separate the two at this point. He just plays this smug, arrogant, brilliant ape to a T. Like, it's so good.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's great, and kind of the verbal chess I think we see between him and, of course, the great Clancy Brown as Lex Luthor is so much fun to pair those two guys together. As we said, that the two guys that are both used to always being the most powerful, the smartest guy in the room, now being kind of forced into cooperation, but at the same time, it's also somehow feels like a competition. And then going back and forth, I think especially in that first scene where it feels like Grodd's trying to get at him. He's like, oh, you've still got the spark. You're too much of a, you know, a power player to sit on the sidelines for too long. And, you know, Lex sort of dismisses him and tells him that, no, you don't, like, I don't want to do any of this. I was a god for a second. Like, that's the only thing I'm ever thinking about or will ever be thinking about. And you feel like, you know, so Lex doesn't have anything to gain. And then Grodd, of course, knowing that's where the conversation was going to go, produces the rock with the Brainiac symbol on it. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, you mean Brainiac, like this little piece of him that is allegedly the only piece of him left in the entire universe. That's like, so the little like verbal chess where it feels like one is always a step ahead of the other. And right when Lex thinks Grodd doesn't have anything he wants or anything that he could do to make him want to work with this crew, he produces the one thing in the entire universe that Lex wants. So yeah, great job by Mr. Booth. And yeah, Clancy Brown gets a lot to do here. Again, he's really good. I think it's more fun almost when we don't hear Corey Burton's Brainiac responding to him, and we just hear him just talking out loud to someone we can't see or hear. Playing the idea of like, is this guy just completely lost it? Yeah. Which, as we've talked about, could be a theme. That's going to be like a running theme for every one of the episodes we cover, I think, in this season, is where are we currently on whether or not Brainiac is real in Lex's head or not. So in this episode, I think he's just a lunatic. So, and a lot of that comes to just how kind of weird and manic Clancy plays him in those scenes. And then, like we said, the great line of if I were 20 years younger and Lex cutting him off to shout, you'd still be ancient. It's incredible. It's so mean and so funny. A great, like I said, great line, great bit of dialogue by Mr. McDuffie, and just delivered perfectly by Clancy Brown. Another on the list, like a Corey Burton, like a Mark Hamill.
Yep.
Where you just go, what else do you say? He did a great job. But yeah, he, like I said, he's getting to delve even deeper into like this this weird psycho energy that Lex has never really had before. So even this far down the road, I feel like he's still surprising us or mixing in new elements.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's hard to add more onto the things that we say each and every time. But the fact that he kind of gets to play this dually faceted, unhinged at times, but also still trying, like he slips in and out of that unhinged nature that we saw at the very end of the last season. So I do like that he still gets to go back to that sort of lunatic Luthor, but still also playing it kind of like somewhat what we were familiar with from the Superman the Animated Series. So I like that he gets to go back and forth between both of those, and every single interaction that he has with someone on screen this episode is just amazing.
Absolutely. And then we just have our Justice Leaguers to round it out. We do briefly get George Newbern as Superman making a brief appearance at the start of the episode, and being he's just kind of there. He does some exposition about the Keys powers, and they have that introduction with Mr. Faraday, and then he's on a video screen a little bit later. But our main Justice Leaguers are Maria Canales Barrera, of course, playing not only Shaira, but God bless her, she's trying to do this Brazilian accent for Fire. And like, to be fair, I don't know a ton of Brazilian people. Maybe this is a very accurate accent, I don't know, but it's just very clearly Maria Canales doing another voice.
Uh-huh.
And as we've talked about, that can be a little distracting, and we'll talk about it in a second with Michael Rosenbaum too. But yeah, I don't, like I said, I don't think she's doing a bad job in a bubble, but it's just so clearly Hawkgirl is talking to herself in a lot of this episode, and it's just kind of weird.
Agreed. Yes, they're in the same scene, they're talking to each other. There's not enough of a difference in the cadence or the pitch in which she speaks to differentiate. And so even if it is an accurate Brazilian accent, it sounds like someone trying to do a bad accent.
Yes.
So not ideal that they cast her. Is this the first full episode where we've heard Fire speak also? Was there another episode?
This is the only one where,
okay,
where she speaks.
Yeah, like it's not to say that the talent isn't there, because we obviously know that Miss Canales is very talented and we have appraised her for a lot of great work on the show, but I feel like you could have, was there an actor's strike like happening at this time? Like why anyone that wasn't appearing on screen at the exact same time, probably would have been preferable in this case, because it is wildly distracting and at times very much takes away from what you're watching on the screen. And
yeah,
using and it is in this case, in my opinion, it is a detriment to the overall experience of the episode.
Yeah, like I feel like we're repeating ourselves, but like, yeah, it's nothing wrong with the performance itself.
Yeah.
Although it does sound like Miss Canales Pereira's character, she was like the popular girl on Danny Phantom, okay, and that's the voice she did like on that show. So her doing that as Fire is also distracting for me as someone who watched a lot of that show growing up. But yeah, like it's just very obviously her, and it's distracting. And yeah, surely there is another Latina woman who does voice acting that was available in 2005 or whatever when they were recording this. But regardless, like I said, I think she does very good as Hawk Girl. There's some really good interplay with her and the Flash, as we'll talk about. You know, there's a very clear, they perhaps more than maybe other than like Batman and Wonder Woman, mm-hmm, feel like they have like the strongest kinship, and obviously theirs isn't a romantic chemistry. They have this very, I think the Flash even says she's like a big sister to me at one point in the episode. Like they have this very sibling bond where she's sort of annoyed by him at times, but ultimately is clearly always looking out for him and kind of pushing him to do it, whether it's trying to get him to ask Fire out or yelling at him because she thought he had perished, had fallen to his death over Black Hawk Island. So yeah, very good as Shiera as always, but yeah, not great as the pulling double duty as Fire there. But speaking of, if you think double duty is distracting, Michael Rosenbaum as of course the Flash in this episode, also playing the agent who's yelling at the Justice League at the start of the episode, also playing Dr. Polaris, who sounds just like the agent who's yelling at the Justice League at the start of the episode. There's somebody else too, isn't there? I think he's playing four.
Yeah, there was someone else.
Maybe he's playing two of the agents. I can't.
Yeah, I don't know. It's, again, we run into the same issue. He's great as the Flash. I love the little bit where he can't even form words to speak to Fire. So funny. Yes. When he says I'm a helicopter, I cackled. Really, really funny stuff. And I think we talked about it. I think, is it season one where we don't get a lot of the Flash, or is it?
Yeah, he doesn't appear at all in the first like 13 episodes of the show, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. I mean, the Flash appears, but he doesn't speak in those first 13 episodes at all.
So it's good, especially after how pivotal he was to the finale of season two, that we get him in a starring role in this episode. But casting him as three characters was certainly a choice.
Get George Newbern to play somebody here. Like, right. Get one of our other male actors besides Corey Burton to maybe try something.
Maybe Mr. Sirianni could have played somebody. I don't know.
Get Bruce Timm in the booth. Hey, Andrea Romano is the computer who announces the self-destruct sequence is starting.
There you go.
Could have pulled Bruce or somebody in the one of the other producers into the VO booth to be Dr. Polaris or whatever.
Yeah, agreed. It's, again, overall the performances in a vacuum would be fine. It's just when you match them up with so many duplicates of the same person talking, it's just a little bit distracting. So for all of those reasons, is there anybody else to cover?
No, that's about it.
All right. For all of those reasons, I ended up settling on a 7 out of 10 for voice acting. And again, I don't think it's, I feel almost bad for doing so because there was a lot of good in the episode. It's just distracting to have so many of this. So it's a rare, I would say maybe, I guess no one bats 1,000, right? It's a rare miss for our, whatever the reason was. Maybe there was some sort of sickness that prevented people from being able to come into the studio that day. I don't know. But for whatever the reason, casting multiple people or the same person as multiple characters in an episode that's 21 minutes or 22 minutes that has those same characters interacting with each other on multiple occasions, not ideal in my world. So that's why I ended up on that 7 out of 10. What about you?
Yeah, I went 1 point lower at 6 out of 10 for the what we've just talked about. It's I don't think anybody is bad. I don't even think any individual performances, as we've said, are bad or awful or anything, but it's just distracting how many times you hear the same people in this episode. And that, like I said, I think there's some really strong stuff, especially with some of our guest characters, and Maria Canales Pereira as Hawkgirl is really good, and Rosenbaum's Flash is really good, and of course, as we mentioned, all the fun stuff with Powers Booth and Clancy Brown playing off each other is a lot of fun. But yeah, it's just like it's one of those ones where I think the sum of the parts is greater than the whole. Is that the reverse of that term?
I think so.
Or the whole is not as good as the sum of its parts, or something. It should be better based on who's in it, but I think it's just, you're really tapping the limit. And usually when Rosenbaum does multiple voices, he's doing like an impression of somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Like Deadshot is his Kevin Spacey. He does Ghoul is his Christopher Walken. I think there's another one he does too. But here they're just all very,
Michael Rosenbaum talking in a slightly deeper voice. It's just really distracting, along with, as we said, Miss Canales Pereira's attempt at a Brazilian accent. Just you know, swing and a miss, as you said.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, it's not the best example of what we'll point to if we're putting on a masterclass of episode that features a lot of. It's weird. It's a lot of great voice actors, just not an ideal situation for everybody involved. So let's total things up here, Liam. We've reached the end here, so it's time to total up our scores. Totaling everything up on my end, I end up with a surprisingly pretty high, I guess because of my animation and music scores, ended up giving this a 32 out of 40. What about you?
And I'm just a couple points lower at a 29 out of 40. I mean, rewatchability, you kind of got to watch it because it's the it's the season premiere. It's setting up the whole rest of the season. So, yeah. And like I said, it's as we've talked about, there's a lot of fun visual nods, especially if you're like a deep DC Comics nerd. Like, there's stuff again when I have to look up what the hell they're talking about, you know, there's some deep cuts here. And so that's a lot of fun. And again, some of the bringing back the Black Hawk character and all of that from the Savage Time episode, not really a character where, unless they did another time travel episode where they went back to World War II again, it didn't really, you wouldn't never really have thought that there would have been a way for them to revisit any of those characters or set pieces or anything like that. So it's a creative way to get to that. And so, yeah, I think it gets a thumbs up. It's a fun enough episode, even if there's some holes in the boat, but it's not sinking.
Agreed. Agreed. Yeah. I'd say for the kickoff to the episode, for this season, as I mentioned at the top, there's a lot of threads here that are going to be explored down the line here. You kind of need to know how things are being set up. So yeah, I definitely give this two thumbs up as far as rewatchability. It's important to the overall story arc for this series. It's the very next episode in the linear time sequence of what's going on after the exciting finale of season two, and really sets the precedent for what we're to expect for the rest of this really just kick-ass fun season that ends up wrapping things up here. So excited to see what that brings as we continue along with our reviews here, Liam, in the month of April. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Don't forget, if you'd like to support the podcast, we invite you to do so a few different ways. The most easiest is not the proper English. The easiest way to do so is to go ahead and subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app, whether that's Apple Podcast or Spotify. And if you like us, you leave a 5-star review for us. That helps us out a lot. Both of those apps allow you to do that if you like the pod. If you like us enough to leave us a blurb, a little paragraph on Apple Podcasts, that helps us out even more because that tells people not only what the show's about, but it gives people the opportunity to see it more because of how the algorithm works. So leave us a little 5-star review with a blurb on Apple Podcasts. And if we read your review on the air and you live within the continental United States, we'll send you a little thank you gift after reading your review on air. So thank you to the people that have done that. We encourage you, if you haven't done so already, go ahead and reach out and do so for us. We greatly appreciate it. You can also follow us on social media at DCAU Review, both on Twitter/X and Instagram. We're also on Threads. Liam is faithful to post up one thing on there every now and then. So give us a follow.
Trying to do one a week.
There you go. Wait, hey, you know, it exists. I don't know what the metrics are to gain or to measure whether or not it is a successful platform that will exist in 10 years from now. Yeah. But hey, you know, it certainly exists for people that are staunch in their commitment to avoid Twitter X at all costs. So which is admirable. Can't be unhealthy for anybody. So good for you. But we continue to be on there. So interact with us on any of those platforms. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode, on this change in format from the Justice League Unlimited, you know, the way they decided to shift gears and go with a little bit more fun-based storylines as opposed to the
the heavier, deeper themes of the season two. Let us know your thoughts on that. You can also support the podcast by checking out the two links in our show notes. Check those out. There's a link to our store. You can get a piece of merchandise to support the podcast or become a monthly supporter, as we do have several monthly supporters that support us with their hard-earned cash every single month. So we thank you to those supporters that do choose to support us that way. Liam, we will continue next week with another new episode, which of course can also be found on the Pod Tower, as we mentioned, another way to support the pod. Subscribe to us on there. But what episode will be streaming next week on the Pod Tower as we discuss the next episode of Justice League Unlimited?
Yeah, that's right. So we're going to be picking up it. I feel like it makes sense with this season for the most part to do them in order, because it is kind of a linear serialized story. So our next one will be the next episode in the season order, that being Shadow of the Hawk. So introduction of a lot of the DCAU version of the very zany and complicated Hawkman and Hawkgirl various origin stories over the last several decades of Detective Comics comics. This is the DCAU's attempt to make sense of all of that starting next week.
Very excited to check that one out. It's going to be a lot of fun. But until then, I'm Cal.
And I'm Liam.
And we will talk to you on the next episode of the DCAU Review.
Bye-bye.